And one more housekeeping item. I am so indebted to Christopher Ashe, to Mr. Meredith Klein, and others who have written on Job. Please know that with just about everything I say here today. Here he was, the greatest man of the East, Job. His story is told at the beginning in Job chapter 1 and 2. He had 7 children whom he delighted in and offered sacrifices for routinely, lest they sin, and he covered for them. He had so many thousands of camels and sheep and oxen. He had fields full of ripe grain and servants aplenty. He had everything. And then God entertained the words of Satan, who came and said, "The only reason he serves you is because you were so good to him. But if you remove your protective hand from him, he will curse you to your face." God gave Satan permission to do this, and Job, in the course of a day, lost everything except his health, one messenger after another coming with devastating news. Following that, Satan came back, and God said, "Do you see, the man is still worshiping me, although I don't give him all these good things. He knows that I am worthy of worship." No, says Satan. "If you were to touch his body and thus really get to the inner part of his soul, he will curse you to your face. He is in your hands," said God. "Only don't kill him. Do anything you want up to killing him." And so Job was smitten with the disease that I suspect, if we were to see him, would shock us terribly and make us back away and be horrified and not want to get near him. And so beginning at the end of chapter 2, Job's friends hear. It's taken several months probably for the news to arrive to them, and they come and we hear the story about his friends who have visited in order to comfort him from Job chapter 2, beginning with verse 11.
When Job's 3 friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud, and they tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and 7 nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was.
Dennis, the next reading will be almost right away, so thanks for staying there. Yes. Now then, chapter 3 begins as Job speaks the first words of the book about his sufferings that are so terrible. And it's known as Job's lament, Job 3, beginning with verse 1.
After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "May the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said a boy is born that day, may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its light. That night, may thick darkness seize it. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. May its morning stars become dark. May it wait for daylight in vain and not see the first rays of dawn. For it did not shut the door of the womb on me to hide trouble from my eyes."
From a speech later on in the book, it's clear that it took several months for Job's friends living in other parts of the Near East to hear the message, gather together, travel to see him. It seems like it is those number of months that has turned Job from the person we met in chapters 1, the first half of chapter 2, to this. "Naked I came from the womb, naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." We remember hearing about last week. But now, that is just gone, because suffering has a cumulative effect over time, as many of you in this room know. Till now, everything we've known about Job's sufferings, we have seen from the outside as if there were a cameraman hovering about. The sheep that were stolen, the camels that were carried off, the servants that were killed, the fields that were burned, the house collapsing upon his children, the horrific sickness with maggots eating his sores, the unbearable itching, the unbearable pain of his bones, his skin turning black and falling off. But now, beginning this passage, we get a picture of the inside of Job, what he is thinking. For the first time, he expresses the pain of what he's going through. God is not addressed in this passage. Job doesn't address God. He doesn't address Satan. He doesn't address his friends. He's just talking out loud in the agony of his soul. And the friends are close enough to hear. His speech makes no reference to the meaning of his suffering, or to the origin of it, or to whether it was deserved or not. He doesn't blame God or Satan or himself or anybody. This will come later. But here someone said he's just simply a man in his grief. And so Job utters a series of curses. Now, don't think about swear words when you hear about Job cursing. Instead, think about a curse in this sense, where a curse is given where words try to call down some magical power to do harm to somebody or something. He doesn't curse God in the way that Satan had tempted him to do, nor that his wife had advised him to do. Instead, he curses, oddly, the day he was born and the night he was conceived 9 months earlier, and he views his conception and his birth as one event in this poem. Usually when people curse something or someone, they curse the future. I hope a curse comes down upon that man who so did me in. I'm going to go see a voodoo doctor in Haiti and have him stick a pin in a dial and try to make the man sick or die. But Job is so miserable, he curses the past that's over and done. If only this hadn't happened. And in particular, if only I was never born. And speaking of cursing a day, then, he says in verse 8, may those who curse days curse that day, the day of his birth and the night of his conception. There were people who believed that sorcerers of a certain skill could somehow concoct a charm, devise an incantation that would make a given day unlucky so that on that day a woman could not give birth or a couple could not conceive, let's say. And in particular, when he says, let those who curse days curse that day, he's thinking of mythology that was popular back in his day all around the ancient Near East. There was belief in a horrible monster named Leviathan. Leviathan is like our boogeyman, only 10 times worse. 10 is really probably not large enough a number. Leviathan was viewed as this hideous, writhing monster that could cause chaos everywhere. His whole being was set against everything that is good, against the Creator. He could swallow the sun at times when an eclipse came. That was often what people thought was happening. And so Job, whether he believes in this Leviathan or not, because we don't know how much he knows, he's very early in time, the Bible was not written, as far as we know. He wishes that sorcerers would conjure up this Leviathan, much as Christopher Ashe wrote in the movies of The Lord of the Rings, where as the Fellowship of the Ring travelers are going through the mines of Moria, someone accidentally stirs the awful Balrog, if you remember that scene, and this demonic, hideous being that is hardly withstandable. He wants some demonic being to prevent his birth by going back in time and cursing the day he was born. He loathes the fact that he ever came to be. He hates the fact that he's still breathing. Now, he says this in multiple ways. He says in verse 4, for instance, he said, may God not care about the day of my birth. The idea is probably this, it seems. The idea is that God summons each day as it comes. Yes, you the next day, come, it's time for you. Yes, you the next day, come, it's time for you. You the next, oh, not you, the day on which Job is going to be born. No. That's what he's asking would happen. May God not do that. One's birthday is usually a joyful thing. There are candles. Today, well, one of Verna's and my 8 children have a birthday, and I will tell you, every time I see March 30th on the calendar and 7 other dates, just the very mention of the month and the day just makes me light up. But that's the exact opposite for Job. He despises the day of his birth. He says, may that day be shrouded in darkness. This is more powerful than it may seem at first. You remember that when God created the world, it says that God created light. He said, let there be light, and God saw that it was good. Job wants the opposite. He hates the fact that daylight comes over the earth and another 24 hours must be endured. Why does he not want light? Well, for the same reason that movie directors, when they're filming a sad scene, often make it happen on a gloomy or rainy day to set a mood. And he doesn't want the day of his birth shrouded in just any kind of a darkness. He wants it to be overshadowed with a, quote, deep shadow. Most of you probably know Psalm 23 by heart. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, that is the very word that he uses here. It is as dark as a mine shaft, absolutely impenetrable to light. And that's what he wants to happen on his day. He says, may violence be done to that day by the blackness. He might be thinking of an eclipse, which was so frightening, as I say, to ancient people. They had a supernatural dread of an eclipse. Or perhaps he's talking about a sandstorm from the desert. A number of years ago, Verna and I were in the Near Eastern country of Qatar, and several of us were out in the desert on four-wheelers, just sand dunes, driving around when suddenly a sandstorm whipped up. I've never experienced anything like it before or since, but it got so thick, so fast, with the wind absolutely roaring, you could not see 3 feet in front of you. It was amazing. Maybe that's what he's thinking about because he lives on the edge of the desert. And perhaps the thought of his birthday then makes him think back to the night when his parents conceived him. Now, that night turned out to have been fruitful. But Job said, oh, that night may darkness obliterate it. May thick darkness obliterate it. May no shout of joy be heard in it. What shout of joy is he talking about? It may be the joy of his parents' lovemaking. Or it may be the optimism that this night, maybe we created a child. Wouldn't that be great? Job wants that day, that night, ripped off the calendar in calendars all over the world. He said, may that night, may its morning stars, that is the stars that are going to rise that are harbingers of the morning coming, may its morning stars be dark. That is, may there be no promise of a coming dawn from the night where I was conceived. And then in verse 9, he gives a beautiful line of poetry. The English Standard Version particularly renders it beautifully. It says this, speaking of that night, let it hope for light, but have none, nor let it see the eyelids of the morning. Let it not see the eyelids of the morning. Apparently, the Arab poets conceived of the sun as the eye of the day because of its circular nature. But the Arabs conceived of the sun before it rose over the horizon, what was shooting out its rays as a forerunner of what's going to be, and the Arabs would call that the eyelids of the morning or the eyelashes of the morning, the thinking perhaps about a beautiful woman or perhaps about a beautiful child who, when he or she looks you in the face, you just melt because of the beauty. But their eyes haven't opened yet. Maybe they've been asleep, and they're about to open, and so their eyelids start to flutter like the rays of the morning sun. He says, may those rays never come then. No. He says, no, on that dawning. Why? Because the next day did not shut the dawn Do not shut the womb on me to hide my eyes from trouble. He hates everything to do with his birth. Now, of course, these curses of his, they're powerless. They have no teeth. They can't do anything. The past is past, and it's unchangeable. It's all wishful thinking. But he's so miserable, he keeps wishing it anyway. Maybe if he closes his eyes tightly enough and wishes, might it come true. May the night of his conception, he says, be so uncannily dark, with no sun, no moon, no candles, and may it never be followed by the morning stars of dawn. May the day of his birth, as we said, be ripped from the calendar. May this day never share with the other days of the year, holidays, or the coming of spring, or a beautiful fall afternoon. And now, halfway through his lament, he asks, along with most suffering people in the world, a series of five questions that in English are comprised of three letters, W-H-Y. Five times now, he will ask, why? Job chapter 3, beginning with verse 11.
Why did I not perish at birth and die as I came from the womb? Why were there knees to receive me and breasts that I might be nursed? For now I would be lying down in peace. I would be asleep and at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who build for themselves places now lying in ruins, with rulers who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not hidden in the ground like a stillborn child, like an infant who never saw the light of day? There the wicked cease from turmoil, and there the weary are at rest. Captives also enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave driver shout. The small and the great are there, and the slave is freed from his master. Why is light given to those in misery, and life to the bitter of soul? To those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than for hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave. Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For sighing comes to me instead of food. My groans pour out like water. What I feared has come upon me. What I dreaded has happened to me. I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, but only turmoil.
Why? How many times over the course of a lifetime have the people in this room asked that question? Why, God? It is the universal question of people languishing in misery, and comforters of people suffering feel helpless when the why question is asked because it seems to have no answer. The first why is, if I had to be born, why did I not die in those first few breaths? Instead, I was placed on my mother's knees, and I was nursed by her at the comforting breast. And the second why he gives is, or better yet, why, when I was born, did I not come out stillborn? That is, did I not die in the womb and merely had to come out and be immediately buried? For Job, death has become sweeter than life to him. And he expresses it in this way. He says, why is light given to those in misery? Think of this, perhaps. Think of the Vietnam War, where so much of the fighting was in the densest jungle and at night, and you were captured, and you were blindfolded, and you were taken away, and you were tossed down into some pit or to some awful basement room. It is total darkness. And now daylight comes, and for the first time, you can see, but all you can see are the confines of your prison cell. That doesn't give any pleasure from light. So he says, why is light given to me? I hate what it lets me see. In verse 13 to 19, he imagines what it would be like to be dead, to be in the grave, and he craves it. He thinks here of death and the grave as a restful place. And as you read down through the verses, he pictures two groups that are there. He starts with the first group. He says, there are kings and counselors and rulers. By kings, of course, he means people who are on the top of the heap. They have the top status, but their castles that they once built grandiosely are now in ruins. And the counselors are their senior ministers of state, like a president's cabinet, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the Treasury, and so forth. And rulers are just a general term here, princes, I believe, just for people who are the great in society, CEOs, billionaires, senators, that sort of a person. Now, that is what who is here. But then the second group there are, before we leave them, he also talks about the slave drivers that are under the employ of these people we've just mentioned. And he calls all these great, powerful people the wicked in verse 17, because they often are wicked and they use their power to oppress other people. But then he says there's a second group in the grave, and these are all the nobodies. He talks about the weary and the captives and the slaves. In summary, he says, in the grave, both the great and the small are there. Why does he want to be there with these powerful people that he has called wicked, who are oppressing other folks? Well, he gives an answer. He says the reason he wants to be there is because there the wicked, quote, cease from turmoil. He doesn't mean their own turmoil, like they had some hardships in life and now they're at rest, although they are, but he says they are ceasing from the turmoil that they cause other people. They cease in the grave from the ability to make any trouble for anyone. Can you imagine whom Job is thinking about when he says this? Is he not thinking about the Sabaeans who came and took all his flocks and murdered all his servants? Is he not thinking about those armed cutthroat Chaldeans who came and stole all his camels and murdered all his servants and ruined his life? They now are powerless in the grave, and thus the weary are at rest. As he says in verse 18, captives in the grave enjoy their ease. They no longer hear the slave drivers shout. Life's troubles are behind. That is the kind of place Job longs for, when the problems of this life are done and you can sleep in peace. Job says he longs for death like treasure hunters search for gold. You've probably read about or seen movies about the gold rush in the American West in the 1800s. People were absolutely fanatical, sold everything they had, spent every last penny getting out there in the hope of panning for gold and hitting a vein and getting rich. But although he longs for death, he can't get there. He's afraid to take his own life because he knows it's wicked and he doesn't know what punishment God may have awaiting for him if he does. In 1927, there was a musical called Showboat. I believe it's been redone several times. A lot of it is about the plight of black workers back in the days of steamboats working on the Mississippi River as stevedores and such. And on one moving song that's sung, I heard this decades and decades ago, and I remember like it was yesterday, there's one older black man who's worked all his life, and he's contrasting his life with the life of the Mississippi River, beside which he has worked all his days. The Mississippi just keeps on flowing in an uncaring way. It doesn't matter what happens to him and his fellow virtual slaves. And so he sings, I'm tired of living, but I'm feared of dying. But old man River just keeps moving along. This is where Job is. And the final why that he gives in this chapter, he says in verse 23, why is life given to a man whom God has hedged in? Does that word hedge ring a bell with anybody of what was said earlier in the book of Job? Sure. Satan said to God at the beginning, God, the reason he serves you is not because he thinks you're so great and worthy of it. He serves you because you have built a hedge around. The word means to fence something in protectively. Well, What's happening now is Job, of course, he never heard that conversation. He has no idea that Satan used the word hedge. Job says that God has hedged me in, meaning God has put me in a prison that I cannot get out of. As someone has said, it's like a hedge of razor wire. That's what he's experiencing. And so he says, I experience sighing instead of food. I think he means by that sighing is my food. Just like normally you'd eat at least 3 times a day and maybe snack in between. So numerous times a day, just sighing comes to me with that same regularity. And my groans are poured out like water. Now someone has said, groans are what you hear in the hours after an earthquake and the collapse of all the building. Groans are what you hear after a terrorist bomb goes off at the Boston Marathon and people's limbs are lying about. This is what he is experiencing. And so he summarized it in verse 25 and 26. He said, what I feared has come upon me. Do you remember we found last week, looking in chapter 1, that Job was an anxious man? He was always afraid that maybe his children had sinned and God would punish them and he would lose them. So he's constantly offering sacrifices for them, trying to cover his bases with God religiously in a righteous sort of a way. Well, exactly what he feared happened, and all his children are dead. He had prayed often for each child. He had sacrificed often for each child, but to no good effect. And the last words of what he says are, I have no peace, no quiet, no rest, only turmoil. This chapter is like Psalm 88, which, as many of you know, is the only psalm in the Bible that has nothing positive in it. It is just almost a screech of pain to God about all that has gone wrong. So what are we to make of this and to learn from it? I want to say right from the start that one of the things that for me makes Job so very hard to preach on, beside the fact that it's like you need to really grasp all 42 chapters because before you can speak on one of them, and I found it very difficult, one of the things that makes it hard is that we know Jesus Christ is the theme of the Bible. But that doesn't mean, I don't think, that every individual verse or individual paragraph in Job has the theme of Jesus. You might say this, Jesus is where all our thoughts eventually must go. But from Job, it's not a straight line from any chapter in Job up to Jesus. It is a line that winds and eventually gets to him, and it's important, and we will do that. But on any given week, the straight line to Jesus isn't so straight and not quite there. Chapter 2 ends in this way. His suffering was very great, which gives us our first principle then. And the first principle is this. God sometimes lets righteous people suffer horrifically. Horrifically. Some of you in this congregation are there. Some of you watching online are there. Some of you have people near and dear to you who are there. Now, that's a fascinating principle, that God lets righteous people suffer horrifically at times. Many people, and you probably know some, many people have left Christianity or they were dallying with it, toying with it, thinking about it, and then decided no way because they saw people who were serious about following God and attending church and so forth, and God let terrible things happen to them, and they said, therefore, if that's the kind of God there is, I want nothing to do with it. I think it's a bunch of baloney. And yet this passage is clear, if we take it in light of all 42 chapters, that God sometimes lets righteous people suffer terribly. God himself affirmed that Job is righteous. And as we read through Job, and you see some of the things he says that take you aback, do you really want to say that, Job? He shoots from the mouth at times that makes you want to blush and think, oh man, don't say that, don't say that. And yet, do you remember, at the very start of the book, God himself affirmed Job as righteousness. God said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? As I say, language used for people like Abraham and Moses and Daniel. There is no one like him on earth. He is blameless and upright. He fears God and he shuns evil. And then after Job gets all his trials, except for his boils, And Satan goes back and says, if you strike his health, he'll do the same. God said the same. He is blameless, not sinless, but blameless. He is trying to do what's right. He works hard at it. He confesses when he sins. He's not a different person on the outside than he is on the inside. But what's more interesting is that at the end of the book of Job, chapter 42, when all is said and done, despite all the things that have come out of Job's mouth that we wish had not come out, God says in 42, verse 7, God says to one of Job's friends, I am angry with you and your two friends because you have not spoken of me what is right as Job, my servant, has. So here you go, a righteous man who is spewing out the words of Job chapter 3. And as someone has said, Job is not being punished for his sins, but the reverse. Job is being tried because of his conspicuous godliness. Many of you will know the name William Cowper, C-O-W-P-E-R. I heard one time it was pronounced Cooper. I just can't verify that. I didn't have time to follow it down. William Cowper, William Cooper. God let this very strongly devoted saint of his go through a terrible night of the soul, even though he hadn't fallen into some deep sin. He was a Christian poet. He died in the year 1800, so he did all his work in the 1700s, and he's written some of the church's most treasured hymns. You may remember, God moves in a mysterious way. You may remember, there is a fountain filled with blood. We often sing it on Good Friday. He was a close friend of John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace. But here's what happened to Cowper. Forgive me if I mispronounce it. He was age 6 when his mother died, and it set him into a tailspin, much like C.S. Lewis when his mom died. His dad sent him to a boarding school, and he was so bullied in that English boarding school, which were horrific in the day by almost all accounts, that he never fully recovered from that. When he came of age and met a young woman, he was engaged, and 2 years into his engagement, his father forbade them to be married. Now, before his conversion, because he wasn't converted yet, he fell into deep episodes of depression. He wrote, I was struck with such a dejection of spirits as none but they who have felt the same can have the least conception of. Day and night, I was upon the torture rack, lying down in horror and rising in despair. After age 31, he had a total psychotic breakdown. 3 times, he tried to take his own life. He was committed to an insane asylum that happened to be run by an evangelical Christian. And 3 months into his time in that asylum, he became a believer in Jesus. He wrote this, unless the Almighty arm had been under me, I think I should have died with gratitude and joy. My eyes filled with tears, and my voice choked with transport. I could only look to heaven in silent fear, overwhelmed with wonder and love. And yet, 4 more times in his life, he fell into deep, long, depressive episodes. And shortly before he died of dropsy, one of his last words was this, I feel unutterable despair. Does that surprise anyone here? In what way it should, and in one way it shouldn't. This is the mystery of God's part in our sanctification, our part in our sanctification, what Jesus allows to happen to us, what we bring on ourselves. But here, by all accounts of people who know him very well, he was an exceedingly righteous man who went through what we just described. God sometimes calls righteous people to suffer terribly. A second principle is this. It is important. I think we might say it is critical for believers to acknowledge another person's suffering before they try to explain it. To acknowledge it first. And then pray for wisdom at the right timing to try to explain it. I remember having a discussion once that was very helpful. You can go off the path any one of two ways. You can quote Romans 8:28 in the first 60 seconds after a person finds his son who has just committed suicide in the bedroom. Or you can fail to bring any scripture to bear to that person until a year later. How do you balance that? Only the Holy Spirit can give you wisdom. But there is something about weeping with people first that is so critical. It's been noted by almost anyone who's ever read the book of Job that the best thing Job's three friends ever did is at the beginning. When they came, they saw him, they sat, they put ashes on their heads, they wept with him, and they said nothing for 7 days. That goes a long way. Romans 12 says that we are to mourn with those who mourn. So yes, have your Bible. Study it to what you should say as the opportunity comes and as the Lord opens the door. But weep with somebody before giving them advice that might feel trite, even though it's not trite. Another principle is this, the last we'll look at. It is appropriate for a Christian to groan, and sometimes to groan long and loudly. Steve Boyer said at the beginning that there is a certain take on Christianity that's possible to give off, and that is because Jesus said, I've come to give life and give it more abundantly, that everything we have to say about the Christian life is one of victory and joy if we only grasp it with enough faith. And so our Christianity becomes shallow and trite and superficial and ignores the kind of passages we looked at this morning during our service. Someone put it this way. Someone said that they would have had Jesus singing a chorus at the grave of Lazarus, which I appreciate that. Do you remember when Jesus stood at the grave of Lazarus? A lot of you kids know this. Can anybody quote it out loud? What is the shortest verse in the Bible? Jesus wept. He wept, of course, seeing the death of Lazarus, seeing the pain it caused his sister, seeing what the devil had done to this world. Have we not thought that within 10 minutes he knew he would raise Lazarus from the dead? But he wept anyway. He felt the pain of what sin has caused, both to God and to humans. And so if Jesus weeps, we should learn to weep as well. We know that it's appropriate for a Christian to groan, and sometimes to groan long and loudly, because of what we read about our Savior in Hebrews 5:7. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions, here it is, with loud cries and tears. We will ultimately need to come to terms with Jesus in order to close up the book of Job in a number of weeks. But for now, the line is not terribly straight, and this is the line we'll leave with today. Jesus wept and groaned over the suffering that he knew he was going to solve very soon. Could I ask that we would bow our heads and pray for your own suffering, or the suffering of someone you know, hopefully suffering that is great, or the suffering of some group of people on the other side of the world that you've never met but you care about deeply. As this music plays, would you speak to God in the form of a lament that weeps but that does have faith?